in this segment of the IRW project, and which we're recording on tape, some of the history of radio and electronics in South Australia, we're speaking today to Ted O'Neill. Welcome, Ted, and perhaps we could ask you to perhaps start off by giving us some idea how you first became interested in radio or radio equipment.
Well, first of all, I guess it was probably when I was at school. I was at Adelaide Technical High School, and I guess when we got into physics, that was really what started me off. But I was destined at that time to become a pharmacist. My father was a friend of the of an accountant who was based in Burke's Chemist Building in what is now Rundle Mall, and he was a director of Burke's Chemist and had been fixed up that I was going to become a pharmacist, which I love chemistry, so it was all right. I wasn't concerned about that. But then in 1936, my father died as a result of an accident, and he'd sort of kept a small business, an engineering business, going right through the Depression. But without him, we were suddenly found ourselves in a rather parlous state. So it so happened that I had to get a job. And I was in the city with my mother one day, just not long after my father died, and we ran into another old friend of his who said, what's happening? And my mother said, well, he has to get himself a job. And of course, 36, things weren't all that good. So he said, here's my card. He said, you're interested in wireless, aren't you? And I said, yes. So he said, well, here's my card. You go around and see Mr. Ern Smith at Ern Smith's in Gawler Place. And so I ran around and saw old Ern Smith, and I think I saw his brother Ozzy as well at the same time. And they then sent me around to National Radio in Pirie Street, which was managed by, I think he was a Swede, Lindbergh, big man. And I got a job there, and of course I promptly started at the old School of Mines set up, the old radio course down there. And I stayed there for quite a long while, and of course in those days John Allen was there, and the sales manager, well, it was Lindbergh was the manager. The sales manager was Kev Wadham, who in later years was the big shaver man. He and Teddy Mills had the shaver business in the city, but he was the sales manager. And as I said, John Allen was there. Of course, he was doing he used to do all the design work. And other names that probably will ring a bell with Arthur Bate was there. Al Smythe. Who else was there? Oh, Doug Strangway. I don't know if anyone knew Doug, but his father was a detective, but a big boy, Doug. But so I worked there for a number of years, well, a couple of years, I guess, and then Lindbergh left, and he'd been enticed away by a division of S&A, a Melbourne radio manufacturing company, who opened up a branch here in Adelaide, which they called AZ, which was in Grote Street, just a little bit west of Her Majesty's Theatre, where Her Majesty's Theatre is now. In fact, there's an open-air car park on the site now. And that had been a shirt factory where they had teams of girls making shirts. And AZ carried on, I forget how long now, it's a long while ago, but they eventually were, Radio Corporation bought out the manufacturing side of Ern Smith's, the national side, and also I think they probably already owned the AZ setup, which was S&A, of course, in Melbourne. And they combined the two, and all of us, that including Lindbergh, that had left National, we probably got the sack. They didn't want us anymore, you see. So, and in fact, Kev Wadham became the manager then of the whole setup. But so at that stage, after looking around for a while, I went to work for old Bill Bland at Bland Radio. And besides doing this course at the School of Mines, I did an ICS course as well, and read everything I could lay hands on. And then, of course, I was just over 18, and I was running my own public address business. I was living down at Glenelg at that time, and there was a fellow was the member of the Glenelg Model Band, and one of the jobs that we used to do regularly was from the bandstand on Collie Reserve, a Sunday night concert. And this guy was played, I think it was a cornet or something he played, but anyway, he came over to me and he said, whose gear is that? And I said, mine. And he said, do you want a job? And he was the owner of Glenorg Sport and Radio in Jetty Road in Glenorg. And I went with him as he's doing radio service.
Was that a chap named Dorset?
No, Jack Dorset. Jack Dorset worked for this fella before, but his name was Bert Crabb. This fella, he was a furniture man really, and he had Glenorg Furnishes as well as Glenorg Sport and Radio. Jack Dorset actually worked for him, and I think Jack went into the Air Force or something, and that's why this vacancy came up. I'll tell you a funny story about Jack a bit later on, but anyway, I stayed there I think I was there for about 12 months, and considering those times, this is sort of, 39-ish, 39-40-ish, and before I was 19, I was averaging about £5 to £6 a week, which wasn't bad money for that age in those times, you know. But so I ran that radio service department. Then I got the bug and I joined the Air Force, of course, so that was that. I then trained at RMIT, and I joined a squadron up in, well, New Guinea in the Torres Strait Islands, and based primarily on Horn Island, 32 Squadron. It was a Hudson General Reconnaissance Squadron, and we had offshoots at Milne Bay and at Jackson Strip at Moresby, and also down at Milne Bay. But we weren't up there very long, because in no time short we were left with two aircraft that were barely flyable. The rest we'd lost on the ground through bombing and everything. And I came back here, or we came back, from Thursday Island in the Ormiston down to Sydney, and then everyone went on leave, sort of thing. And I arrived, we moved, the squadron moved into Camden Aerodrome, just out of Sydney, and when I got back there from my leave, everyone was in a panic, because I'd been posted to Air Force headquarters. And in fact, I then went there, I was there for a couple of years, and I was in a section which was known as S6, which was a development setup, among other things. I was a sort of the boy assistant, if you like, to various people. One of them, we developed a height indicator for torpedo dropping from Beaufort aircraft. Nice. It worked on a Doppler principle, you know, and because the optimum height for dropping torpedoes was 60 feet from aircraft, and it was very, very, it was essential that height be very accurate, because torpedo will either nose in or it will bounce if the height isn't dead right. And we developed this system, and in fact we flight tested it from Nowra, which in those days was an Air Force aerodrome, not a naval aerodrome. And some very funny experiences there too, but that's beside the point. The first of these height indicators, and it wasn't a full-blown radio altimeter at that stage. We then did go on to the development of a radio altimeter later, but the first prototype was made actually by STC, and we went up to Sydney. We took a Beaufort aircraft up there, and we actually installed the thing at Mascot, and we were then going to fly down to Nowra, and we based at Nowra for the trials. And it was rather disconcerting, because we taxied out and we were actually in a taxiway, and there was an American B-25 Mitchell came in to land without any wheels up, and in fact he landed in the dirt alongside. When we're flying this aircraft, and you see one, just this is your going out, this one's coming in, and a great cloud of dust, and team of Yanks got out and said, "Oh well, that's that one finished," you know, and walked away. But anyway, we flight tested that system down there, and then that did go into production. We then went back, and the fellow that was actually in charge of the development was a fellow called Ron Hope, who he was an electrical engineering graduate from Tasmania, from Hobart, but he'd gone to England soon after graduation, and he worked as a virtually a cadet engineer for BTH, I think it was, and from there he went to STC, and he was involved actually in design development at STC, but he had joined the Royal Air Force Reserve, and he'd actually trained as a pilot, but they wouldn't let him fly, he was too valuable. Yeah. And in fact he came back out here to Australia work on the on a Lorenz blind flying, you know, where a tracking system, you know, the what do they call it, Lorenz beacon system.
That's right.
And but we actually got involved in that as well with the system had a, it had an excited middle antenna, and it had two parasitic antennas at one each side, and they had relays, mechanical relays, at the centre of them. And so that on the flight path, if you were dead on, you just got a continuous signal in the aircraft. If you went to one side, you got dots from one relay operating the parasitic reflector, and you got dashes on the other side, right. But you know, they merged into a single thing. Anyway, so I got involved in that as well, and then, we went on to the development of a radio altimeter. But by this time, the Yanks radio altimeter had sort of come to fruition, and they sort of became freely available, and that was dropped. But at that same time, there was a very, very important requirement for VHF radio telephone set for fighter aircraft. And you probably both will remember the SCR-522, the American thing. Well, prior to that actually coming out here, we did the development of an FM VHF system, which instead of course the SCR-522 was AM, but this was FM, yes. The system here, and it had a lot of ours had a lot of features in it, in that it was an automatic tuning system, in that it was the selected frequency, when that frequency, when you hit resonance at that frequency, the thing actually switched itself off, and it never had all these mechanical cams and push rods and everything the SCR-522 had. So we actually went we got that to virtually to a prototype stage, and Radio Corporation were going to make this thing in Melbourne, and in fact they'd started, and we were working in conjunction with them on the prototypes, when suddenly somebody in authority said, cut, that's it, that project's finished, and we weren't going to go on with it, you see. So Radio Corporation, of course, working on cost plus, had plenty of money, so they threw a big party for all the people that had been involved, you see, which we enjoyed ourselves at. Then 3 weeks later, the thing was revived again, you see. That lasted for another 3 weeks, and then it scrubbed again, so we had another big party. But that's how that one was never ever finished. But
this
then
is the RAF people doing the development of all.
Yeah, well, yeah. Oh, you know, when we were doing the height indicator to simulate the delays, we had piles of coaxial cable in the lab. You trip over it, you know, to get the delays. Yes. Yeah. So anyway, at that stage, I also got involved, and I was doing the technical investigation of captured enemy equipment, and any Jap aircraft that crashed in the vicinity of an Australian organism, you know, a squadron or whatever, it was shipped down to us, and so I used to dismantle it and then sort of get the circuitry and write the reports up and everything about it. And in fact, I saw a blatant piece of plagiarism after one of those. The fellow that was in charge of S6 section in the Directorate of Signals was a fellow called Jim Redrop. He was a squadron leader at that time, and he later became Director of Signals and Radar after the war in Canberra. But he called me into his office one day and he said, I want you to take this book, and I want you to, beautifully bound thing, hard covers and so on, he said, and I want you to read from page so-and-so to page so-and-so, and then come back and tell me what you think. And it was a report on a piece of Japanese equipment, ostensibly investigated and written up by the US Army Signal Corps at Fort Monmouth in the States. Right. And so I read it through and I thought, this seems familiar, and it was word for word. I'd written the thing, and the Yanks had claimed it as theirs in their book. But the stuff used to come down in crates, and across the corridor from the lab where we were, there was a room which was where the all the WAFs made the tea for all the various sections, afternoon tea, morning tea time and so on. And the head WAF woman came in one day and she said to my immediate boss, a fellow called Jack Parr, she said, "Mr. Parr, those crates in the tea room there being used, our tea room being used as storage, smell abominably. I wish you'd do something about them," you see. So Jack said to me, "We're going to get that stuff out," see. So we got and opened it up and we knew what the smell was. There was an ear inside jammed in one of the pieces of equipment. But from then, I went on to, I was seconded to the Directorate of Met Services, which of course was being run by the Air Force in those days, and they'd started using a radio sound system for upper atmosphere sounding, you know, and the principle being that you had a balloon, immediately below the balloon you had a parachute, which of course was stretched out tight and hanging on that, you had the little transmitter. And the transmitter had a humidity sensor and a temperature sensor, which actually all it did was it was a little the old original 1.5 volt filament battery valves. It was a twin triode. One section was an RF oscillator at about 70 megs, and the other section was an audio oscillator. The temperature and humidity elements were, in fact, resistors, so that the tone generated by that audio oscillator was determined by the value of that resistor. And they were selected alternately by a switch, a barometric switch. It was an ordinary aneroid barometer mechanism, and it wiped across alternate metal and insulating segments, so that when it was on a segment, a relay closed and it went to, say, the temperature element, and when it, the next segment being an insulating element, the relay stayed open, and you got the humidity element switched in, you see, so it was just a changeover relay. And the exercise of me being seconded to the Director of Met Services, which was up in Victoria Street in Carlton in Melbourne, was to train people in the maintenance of these things, because the Met people had suddenly decided they were going to use radio sound, but they'd forgotten that these things do go wrong, you know. And the system that they used, the receiver system, had been designed by PMG Research in Melbourne. And the Yanks used a different system. They had almost completely different in that. The receiver, their equipment was actually made for the Bureau of Ships in the, you know, the US government setup, and it used an American National 110, which was a superagenitive receiver. It was it had a similar dial on it to the HRA receiver dial, but it was I think it went to about 1 meter or something, one to 10 meters. That was the wavelength range of it. Anyway, and it also had a recorder unit, a cycle array recorder unit, which actually had a tapper bar that came down and tapped every time there was a signal tapped, and so it actually plotted a graph. It was rather a beast of a thing, actually, but. That the American units weren't freely available, and of course PMG Research had designed theirs, and of course they, not having very much to play with, they were using ordinary conventional valves like the old 6U7G sort of thing like that, you know, and to sort of get I forget what the RF frequency was now, it was something around about 10 megs or something like that, because the receiver's working at 70 megs. Yes. And so what they did was they had compartments, and the valves were actually laying on their sides, and they were sort of end to end, so that you minimise the lead lengths and so on. Anyway, that was a beast of a receiver; it never ever really worked properly, and so we had the I was running these courses up in the Director of Met Services for these people that they brought down from the various units, and like in the services generally, if directive comes from headquarters that you send a man to be trained in a particular thing, they never sent their best bloke, because, you know, they didn't want to lose them. They always sent some no hope of the one to get rid of, which was what generally, well, what happened in all of those courses. Anyway, I'd finished these courses and I'd gone back to RAF headquarters and back to the lab. And I was only back there about 3 or 4 weeks, and Jim Redrop wanted to see me one day, and he said, look, he said, we want you to go up to Darwin. There's problems up there. They were having trouble with the early warning radar in Darwin, in that it was... when you'd get a temperature inversion, they'd get a channeling effect, so that the outgoing signal from the radar would sort of get channeled in at a certain level, and it wouldn't spread, you see. And so, of course, there were aircraft coming in and they weren't seeing them. So they, of course, obviously the radio sound equipment was the thing to use for to detect these temperature inversions. And a whole crew from CSIRO, who of course were involved in radar development at that time, arrived up in Darwin to do this, and the radio sound wasn't working, you see. And the bloke that had been trained threw up his hands in horror and said, well, I don't know what to do, you see, so I got sent up there. And when I got up there, you probably remember, if you don't, you've probably read of it, but the head of the division that was doing it, that was the radio physics division, was Dr. Bowen, who had come out from England. He was one of the original people in England involved. And he headed this team, and there were all these people, and they were obviously highly intelligent boffins. And what they did was they gave them army greatcoats and army fur felt hats, which they'd left with the crown fully domed up, and they were just flat brims, and most of them had thick lens spectacles, and they got around with overcoats that were far too big for them in the wet season. It was really amusing. But anyway, I sorted this system out and got involved in having the station moved, actually, because it was in the wrong site. So I had to find a new site, get it all moved and so on, and got it all set up. And I was all ready to head back to Melbourne. And having been in the tropics before with the squadron, I was keen to get out again. You know, anyway, the next thing that happened was a so-called friend of mine who'd been commissioned. I was a sergeant at the time, and this friend of mine arrived on the scene, and he'd gone from a sergeant to do an ANSD course, and he'd been commissioned, and he'd been sent up to Darwin as the signals personnel officer of the Northwest area, which was Darwin area, you see. And he walked in, he said, I've been looking for you. I'm looking for a good sergeant to take charge of this department. I was on the RAF station in Darwin, you see. And I said, Price, go away, you're no friend of mine. But then I finished up, I was stuck there. I then put in the next 22 months up there because he put a special request in. So I ran the section there for two. Well, right until the Japs tossed it in, actually. Mm. And so then I came back here, took charge of the transmitting facilities at the Gawler RAF unit for about 3 months, and then I got out. But I'd sort of didn't know what I was going to do. I was I'd been in charge of the section up there before I was 21, and it was an embarrassing situation because I only had one. I had a staff of about 18 blokes, and there was only one of them was as young as me or younger, and he was about 6 months younger than me. And when you're dealing with blokes of 30, 35, and you're the boss, you've got to be very tactful, and I reckon I learned a lot in that time. Yeah. You know, you learn how to really, you know, hold your tongue, but get things done, sort of thing. But anyway, I thought I'd go, I'd look around, and I went and worked for old Bill Bland for a while after, well, not knowing really what I wanted to do. He welcomed me back with open arms, and then I ran into a friend of mine that I'd been in the service with, and he said, look, why don't you, he said, you'd make it easily. He said, why don't you apply for rehabilitation training, university training? So I said, oh, what hope have I got? He said, well, I got it. He said, I've been approved. And I'll tell you who that was, and you probably know him, Ken Broadfoot. Remember Ken Broadfoot?
Yeah.
Well, Ken was one of my sergeants when I was running the Gawler's and set up. He's dead, old Ken, they tell me.
He's been for a few years. He was one of the lecturers.
I know, yeah.
When I did my course.
Oh, there, yeah.
He took digital techniques.
Tell me he never changed his notes in the whole time he was there. I know a couple of my blokes have worked for me since told me that.
Yeah, he had some funny characteristics.
He was the most introverted man I've ever met in my life.
Mm. Every page was numbered, and the students would sit there and call out, 201, 202.
He had a brother who was completely different, but Ken was the most introverted bloke. Actually, he and I went to Melbourne in the same draft when we joined the Air Force.
Yeah.
I never saw him for years until I landed up there and found he was one of my sergeants in the station. But anyway, Ken said, why don't you apply for this, you see? So I went down. They had the interview section in the old Savings Bank building in Curry Street. And the Savings Bank had moved out, and they just had a lot of sort of plywood cubicles there, you know, and you could hear every word that everybody said to everybody. I was sitting there waiting, and there was a bloke in being interviewed, you see, and it turned out when he came out, he was a sailor, a Navy bloke. And the last words, oh, that's right, he was called back in before I was called back in. And he went back into the same bloke, and the bloke said to him, oh, yes, well, look, the best we can offer you is training as a blacksmith, you see. And I thought, oh, this is the pushover, this is the shunting place, you see. So anyway, my turn, I went in, the bloke said, oh, yes, now here's a letter for you to take down to Adelaide University to the registrar. I said, what's this, you see? And he said, you look surprised. I said, yeah. He said, why? And I said, oh, I thought this was the brush-off joint, you see. And he said, oh, no, you're okay, you passed all the tests, you know, away you go. Well, I went down there and only did 12 months because we were getting £2.10 a week, I think it was, subsistence allowance, of which we paid 8 shillings a week in income tax. And I had a widowed mother and she sort of never had much money, so I had to give it away in the finish. And that's when I actually went, initially, the first time, I went to work for the department. And up in the section with Bert Lampe and all that crew, Roy Buckerfield, and they were good blokes to work with too. I reckon one of the best technical people I ever met was Roy Buckerfield. He was good.
Yeah, he was.
And old Bert was a nice old bloke, you know. When Bert would get angry, he'd start to see the flush coming up his neck, you know, and it gradually spread all over his face. But he... I worked there for quite a while. We did, while I was there, I was one of the team that did the field intensity measurement set up for when they were going to move to Pimpala. Mm-hmm. You know, that was on for years and years and years. Because it was going to be, Northfield was one side.
That's right.
And then Pimpala was another. And we had the red Ford V8 utility, and we had an old army blitz wagon with the transmitter inside it, you know, which we used to take around and erect on the site. But... And then I was enticed away from there. Well, some of the things I was doing there was the acceptance testing of school's broadcast equipment. Mm-hmm. Ted McGrath had apparently got himself involved somehow or other in that, and the department took it on, and I was doing all of those. And then Laurie Simon enticed me away to go with Damus. He wanted me to do design of intercom equipment, you know, they were just becoming the in thing for officers, intercoms. And he and a fella called Bull, this Bull had a sheet metal works down in Brompton, he used to do all of Laurie Simon's metal work for his chassis and cabinets and all that sort of thing. And I went with them on the understanding that I was going to do all the design work and run this side of things, you see. And after I'd been there about 3 months, I finally said to Laurie, well, what's happening? He said, Alf Bull's decided that he doesn't think that, you know, you should get the share you're getting, you see. So he said, I'd like you to just stay on and work for me here. They scrubbed the idea, you see. Well, I wasn't very happy about that because I'd more or less that's what I'd gone there for. And at that time, Philips were advertising for design engineers for mobile radio telephone equipment. So I applied and I went down there and I forget his name now, was the chief engineer in the telecom division down there. He'd come from EMI to Philips, and we used to call him Whispering Death, because he'd come into the lab of a morning and he'd say, well, how's everyone? Are there any problems? Are there any problems? He'd talk like that, you see. And if you said, yes, well, look, we have got a problem. Very busy, must go. He'd say, never stay, there'll be any problems, you know. And so I was involved down there for a couple of years with mobile radio telephone stuff with... for example, we did, before I got there, they'd done the first police installation, two-way radio installation, and then there was a complete redesign from that to a new system, which I did all the design of the selective calling system for, and I also did a major part of the receiver design too. And there was a fellow called Norm Thomas down there who used to do, he did the transmitter design. But the first big one that we did with the new equipment was the South Australian Harbours Board, as it then was now, you know, Department of Marine and Harbours. And we installed their vehicles and pilot launches and mooring launches and all that sort of thing. And it was Oh, we did the first taxi fleet in Adelaide. There was a show was set up called Radio Cabs. They used Vanguard vehicles, and we installed them actually to get them going before one Christmas period. We had three prototype units, and we put those in the vehicles, you know, and managed to keep them, you know, typical prototype things. They were all rat's nests and everything. And we kept them going over the Christmas period with those. And also we did a, there was an installation down in Hobart, and well, we did various other things. We did we did some VHF transmitters for what was then, in those days, LRWE, Long Range Weapons Establishment, yeah. Long before the ordinary WRE. We made transmitters for them. We made frequency shift keying transmitters for the Department of Civil Aviation for the Trans-Pacific. They were driver units. They were a 1 kilowatt transmitter. They were designed actually to drive a much higher, you know, final stage. But and I was involved there for, I forget now how long it was. And then while I was originally in the department, I'd sat for the technician's exam, and of course I'd passed it, you see, because I was already starting to study for the engineer's exam. In fact, I'd done quite a lot of work for it. And then I got the offer of an appointment, and that's when I went to Brooklyn Park, and that's when I went back to the department. Mm-hmm. So I went to Phillips in 48, and I went back to the department, I think, in sort of middle to late 50, 1950. And, of course, I worked for Charlie Ansell. A great experience working for Charlie. Yeah. I suppose he's dead too, is he? I haven't heard of him for years.
Yes, I heard through Bill Walker that he died.
Did you? Mm. Oh, yeah. Anyway, old Charlie, he, you could always get, you know, if you said white was white, Charlie would swear it was black, you know, he couldn't resist it. Funny story, you remember the Fimry, Jack Fimry and Jack Straffin?
Oh, yes, Hackham and Basham.
Yeah. Well, they were down there doing some metal work on the 5-seal transmitter, and we go into the tea room for morning tea, and Charlie came in, of course, with his cup as usual, and sat down and said, "What's the subject for today, you see?" And Jack Fimry said, "Superannuation, Charlie. Now, I think it's the greatest system. The Commonwealth superannuation is the greatest system." This was always Charlie's spiel, you see. "Look, a man can't go beyond it for value and everything." See, Charlie said, "Well, I wouldn't say that exactly. Normally, he'd swear, you know, it was the greatest system of the lot. It's got some, you know, it's got some faults, got some shortcomings, you know. Like, for example, if the husband dies, the wife only gets the half benefit sort of thing, you see. And Fimmery's waiting on him, and when Charlie sort of spilled he thumped the table and all the cups jumped up off the table. And he said, "Charlie, I've been trying to get you to admit that for years, and now you have it." Charlie just got up and stormed out to his stage. But so I went down there, and of course it was a rule of law there. They had a Dumont 5-inch oscilloscope there, which Charlie wouldn't let anyone use. Mm. These newfangled things, yeah. They were no good, you know. And anyway, there was a fault on a limiting amplifier. Remember the Trimax limiting amplifier?
Yes.
There was a fault on one of those. It was running into distortion, see, so I sort of... Charlie said, "Oh, would you have a look at it, Ted?" So I went and had a look at it. Ah. So, it was... it involved shift work and everything, and I don't think shift work's natural for a bloke. I reckon that's last year's, and... I finished up. I got to the stage where I wasn't really happy there, you know. Well, I was happy enough, I suppose, but the hours I didn't like. And do you remember Jack Hurst?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So Jack Hurst had gone out to Salisbury to work for Armstrong, work with aircraft, mm-hmm. Hawker Siddeley again, of course. And Ted Charles. Mm-hmm. And I ran into Ted Charles one day, and he said, "They're looking for a bloke like you out there. Are you interested?" And I said, "Oh, I could be." So he said, "Well, look, I'll have a word with Joe Venn, who was the technical manager." Anyway, I got a ring from this Joe Venn, go out and see him. Well, I finished up, they offered me a job. And it was a lot better money than I was getting in the department, and also the possibility of, you know, going to England for experience and everything. Anyway, struck it at a bad time, of course, because just at that time there was all sorts of strife, and they used to go on Transport Command, RAF Transport Command aircraft, and they weren't available. So I didn't get there, and then I'd been there for quite a while, and working on the Sea Slug anti-aircraft missile system for the Royal Navy. And mainly doing special instrumentation, like looking at wing flutter and panel rippling, you know, on the aerofoil surfaces and all that sort of thing. And among other things, we designed and built an instrumentation tape recorder, an FM instrumentation tape recorder, a recoverable one.
Was this for WRE or was this...
No, this is for Armstrong Whitworth Aircraft.
Right.
Working in that area,
yes.
Of course. I never ever worked for WRE, right. Ever. But then this thing was... it was made so that it would survive the impact of the missile and could be flown again. In fact, we flew the thing about 5 times altogether, and it was quite a good device. And it went back, the design went back to England, and whether they proceeded with it or not, I don't know. But that was actually when we used transistors.
Right.
We actually sort of OC71s and OC72s and OC16s, you know, and in those days the old OC16s, instead of being in the TO3 case, yeah. Type of thing, they were quite a tall thing with a pip on the top.
Right.
And the only failure we ever had with them was with the OC16. We had to replace that every time because the lead from the dice up to the lead at the top always sheared off on impact. But I was with them from 55 to must have been 59. Early 59. I was approached again to go into the television caper at Channel 9, take charge of transmitting facilities there. And of course, along the way, I'd got, you know, broadcast operators, certificates, and all that sort of gear. Anyway, I went up there, and in fact, in conjunction with a crowd called, TV Engineering from Melbourne, it was an offshoot of the Channel 9 setup in Melbourne. They represented Pi, and we had Pi transmitters.
Yep.
And well, in fact, we had Pi cameras too, which were the greatest heap of junk of all time. But anyway, but I was on the transmitter side. And I stayed there right from the word go. We were doing sort of, you know, one night a week, we'd put on a film with the telecine machine actually in the transmitter control room inside a cage of chicken wire to stop the RF from getting at us, you know. And we used to let the telecine operator, we'd open the flap to let him out for a cup of coffee, you know, sort of thing. But anyway, I stayed there until after it went to air permanently, and but again, it bored me to tears. I mean, broadcasting, I'm afraid, I found was the most boring exercise ever, you know. And I decided to toss it in. I was going to have a holiday because when I'd gone to Channel 9, one of the things that I was offered was 500 shares at par in Southern Television Broadcasters, you know, which at five time they worked out, I made a lot of money out of them in the long run. But I decided to have a holiday anyway, and I'd only been on holiday from just before Christmas, and it was about early January, and the Hawker Siddeley people found out that, you know, that I'd tossed the job in, and I had a phone call to ask me if I'd like to join the Avro division, which were doing the Blue Steel missile contract, which was a standoff bomb that was carried under the V-bombers. Mm-hmm. And so I went out there, and I joined them the beginning of February, and on the 1st of April I left for England, and I was in England for 6 months then to work in the avionics division of Avro's at Woodford in Cheshire. And whilst I was there, you know, de Havilland's had the Blue Streak intercontinental ballistic missile system under development. And that was actually cancelled while I was in England, and Blue Steel sort of became the main sort of project that the British government had on. And they were actually doing their firings of Blue Steel from Aberporth in Wales into the Irish Sea. And it was, because Aberporth wasn't very far from the Woodford place in Cheshire, you know, it's just virtually across Cheshire, and Aberporth is just into Wales a little bit, you know, on the coast. So it was decided that I would, because of the, they were being constantly having to cancel trials because of fishing boats in the Irish Sea and so on, with a danger to them or shipping generally, it was decided to transfer the whole of the test program out to Woomera. And so I had to hasten back here to sort of start getting everybody clued up on what had been going on in England while I'd been away, you see. And one of the fellas, Cliff, you might remember, that was actually with Avro's too, was Ron Blythe. Do you remember Ron Blythe? Who virtually drank himself to death while he was working for Avro's. But, and in fact, Ron had gone to England about 3 weeks before I had. And... if you can imagine these big aircraft factories at Woodford, there was a production line of Vulcan bombers. Now it's a very big building that has a production line of Vulcan bombers. That was sort of one row. The next row, there was they were converting Shackleton one aircraft to Shackleton twos by major modifications. Yes. And then on the other side of that again was the avionics division. And anyway, I arrived there and. They said, "Oh, I suppose you want to see Mr. Blythe." And I said, "Oh, yeah. Where is he? Oh, he's down in the end of the Vulcan production line." See, so I went down there, and I swear this is true. People still don't believe me, but in England, of course, it's always sort of misty, and this great building, and down the far end, these great hangar doors were open, and the mist had actually permeated into the building, sort of thing. Mm. And I'm walking down, and oh, there's Ron. I can see his red nose. But so I was over there for about 6 months and then came back here, and then we got into the full-scale program on Blue Steel, which included in the latter stages the commissioning and trialling of a complete test system, which was called Test System Overall Missile, TSOM it was called. And this virtually was, well, it was actually designed because the RAF had a lot of conscripts at that time. And they had a hard core of technical people, that were good technical people, but never had sufficient people to do all the tests that were necessary on this missile system. So they actually had a contract for this where the IRCs just plugged things in and they got yes-no answers or go-no-go answers, And it was a system of 19-inch racks, which was about 25 feet long, all racks all along. And it did everything. It tested autopilot systems, flight rules computer systems, inertial guidance systems, the whole bit, motor control systems, all that, And because I don't know if you ever heard or read of the Blue Steel, but what it did was it was crutched up underneath mainly the Vulcan bombers, and hundreds of miles from its target, it was released. And it actually, the aircraft zoomed away like that, and the missile actually fell nose down for a certain period. Then the control surfaces put it into a nose up attitude. It had two motors, what they call the main motor and the sustainer motor, the rocket motors, which both fired and took it into a high angle climb up to operational height. And then once it reached operational height and levelled out, then the main motor cut out and the sustainer motor just kept it going, you see. And then when it almost reached its target, it went into what was called a bunt phase, when it went into a nose-down attitude straight into the target. And it was pretty good, actually. At Woomera, it always used to land within about the 100-metre circle, that it was aimed at. But and in fact, it did go into operational service probably back in the 60s. I believe it's sort of been phased out now. But so I was there until right at the very end of the program, when I was asked to go back to England again. There was a new program which was it was being done by the de Havilland company, who had since joined the Hawker Siddeley group, or they merged at that time. And it was to go to Hertfordshire to I forget which one of the plants it was now. And I was supposed to take a team from over here because we were considered to be a pretty hotshot team, on trials programs and testing systems. And I was asked to head this team. And just at that time, my daughter had just started university. We were to go for 3 years on a fixed salary basis for 3 years, which I didn't like very much. I knew my wife wouldn't like it in England because I'd spent, I liked the place, but the weather was foul, Well, so when this proposal that I go over to England, of course, I said, no way, you know, I don't think I'll go. Well, they were most upset about that. And so I just sort of stayed and went into the... I missed the point. I said I was leaving. I left them, and then Tubby Vale got me to go back, and I went back into the Hawker Siddeley Dynamics setup. And there we did all sorts of things. I mean, we made... if one day you'd find yourself climbing over a bulk wheat handling... wheat bulk handling plant, you know, sort of thing that happened was, again, the South Australian Harbours Board, there was a political expedient, they were going to put in a bulk handling plant at Port Price or somewhere over on the west coast, and the existing systems they had, the logic in the handling system was all relay logic, in that, as you probably will appreciate, when one conveyor starts, another one must be ready to take its output and so on, you know, and all various gates must be open. Now, I went all through the one at Port Adelaide and sort of had to work out what the logic of the thing was. There was a main conveyor which brings the wheat from the bulk handling people, who are a different proposition. Mm. The Harbours Board ran the conveyor systems and wheat bulk handling or grain bulk handling. They had a door between them, and yeah. One put the wheat onto the conveyor, yeah. And the rest of they conveyed it. You know, anyway, the main conveyor came out, and then at right angles was another conveyor off which the various chutes went out to the holds of the ships. And so these had gates on to control the amount of flow down to the ship and so on. And all this was all logic. It was relay logic. So what they had decided to do, without knowing about it, the chief electrical engineer down there said, "Oh, we'll go all solid state on this. You know, this is what we'll do." So I had the job of doing this, converting all this relay logic into electronic logic and so on, and getting the whole system planned out. And then they asked me, Harbours Board asked me if I could give them, their chief electrical engineer, a one-day course in logic. And I said, well, I think that's a little bit short. He knew nothing about it, you know, anyway.
How did you learn logic? Just out of books? Out of books, training courses?
Yep. No, I never ever did a training course, actually. Mm. You get thrown in and out the deep end, and so you learn, you know.
That's
and
right.
It's sort of, I guess you... I don't know. I guess maybe I was sort of... I was natural, you know. Some people, I don't think they ever would learn. I've found some people you can never get through to them. But I don't know, I just how it came natural to me, you know.
Confronted with a task, so...
That's right, so you do it, yeah. Yes. Mind you, I think it's getting a little bit involved for me now. Like, I can handle microprocessors, but I tend to back off. I leave that to Peter.
Yeah.
But anyway, we planned this whole system out, and we produced a quote for them. Oh, and the chief engineer of the Harbours Board, we went into a meeting with him, and he said, oh yes, well, you know, this logic stuff, it's all this solid state stuff, that's all right, but you know, when you start a motor up with a big contact, you hear it go bang and you know it's closed, you know. And of course, at this stage, I just about had him this day, you see, and I said, well, of course, if that's the only problem, I said, we can put a loudspeaker there, and I said, it'll make a bang when the circuit closes. Oh, that'd be a good idea, he said. That's true. That actually happened. That same chief engineer, I learned later, was actually a naval architect who'd designed a pilot boat, which was built in Port Adelaide and was sailed around to Port Pirie and capsized just the outside of the harbour at Port Pirie because it was unstable. But anyway, so actually I worked there right up until the time, on all various projects, we did all sorts of things. A silly little thing, you know, barely worth mentioning, was I designed a piece of equipment to monitor the manufacture of heating elements for electric blankets. Now, heating elements and electric blankets, you have it's a Teflon, piece of Teflon, and you have a resistance element wound around it. That's all it is. Now, they there was a variation in voltages of these things and everything. And in fact, a crowd that used to be down at Camden. What's the name of it?
Oh, the people who made the wire.
That's right. That's right. God, I can't think of their name now. But anyway,
Camelec.
We did a lot of work for Camelec, and I had to design this thing. And what we actually did was we had a pair of rollers. It was a thing winding the wire on. We had a pair of rollers, which were the contacts, and we actually just measured the resistance over a foot length continuously. And then we had a proportional control back to the winding of the pitch of the winding on the thing. Pretty straight to it. I think we made about 20 of those things. They had them running down there. Those are the sort of things we did. We did all manner of things, just trying to think.
It was with Hawker de Havilland.
It was Hawker Siddeley Dynamics. That was what we finished up being called. And because Hawker de Havilland was really, had control of the whole organisation because they already had a sort of a corporate setup in Sydney. And so consequently, when they decided to, join all these sections together, they became the heads of it, and they were a mob of creeps, I might add. But anyway, it was then that I was introduced to Don Atkinson, and he offered me this job down there, and then from there on, I went down there. I was lucky in that soon after I went there, well, actually before I'd actually started there, there was a new building being built, and I actually was able to even have an input to how I wanted my particular laboratory setup laid out, which was very handy. And in fact, not very long, it had been a fair while afterwards, I suppose. I had a visit from Bill Bilski one day to come up and have a look at what we had there, and because he said, in our place, all they've concentrated on is big corridors and small working areas. He was very unhappy about that. But, so actually that sort of was it right up until, it'll be 5 years ago come Christmas that I finished at Flinders, and it was, I think it was probably one of the best working periods of my life because particularly early on, like when the place was relatively new, you could get the equipment you wanted, yes. Exotic things that, you'd only dream about. I had a requirement there at one time to measure the dielectric constant of a material. And all I had to do was say, look, I want that jig that goes with the Marconi Q meter, or circuit magnification meter, as they call it. It'll fit on there. Yeah, sure, no trouble, And I had it. And you can really do good work when you can get things like that. And
because you're there in the days of the development of that establishment, money was around.
That's right. But then, of course, then came the trough. At the peak there, I had 10 people in that section, and good people, because when I was recruiting technicians, I always used to try and get people that had been trained in the apprentice school at WRE, because they were the tops.
Yeah, they were too.
And they not only were good electronically, but they'd been taught how to use a lathe, and they were taught, mechanical techniques.
And they'd had, work experience, a lot of work experience
in
the labs.
That's right. And at one stage there, I think all but one of my blokes were all ex-WRE apprentices. And one by one, of course. In these blokes, they were all ambitious, and they all moved on to other things. And what happened was, of course, a crunch came, probably about 5 years before I finished there. We reached a real trough where I couldn't even replace staff. And I from 10 people, I got down to 5, and we still had the same workload. And people screaming their heads off because they couldn't get their projects underway.